Good evening, guys. John Hominuk here with New York Metro Weather. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Weather Eyes. A lot to discuss today. We are going to do our best to cover as much as possible. We're going to talk a little bit about the ongoing storms from yesterday that affected the November pattern and the winter that's coming up, including December, January. Maybe we'll touch even a little bit on February. So we have a lot to cover. We have a lot that we'd like to talk about with you guys. And we'd like to remind you the call-in number is 323-870-4. You guys are welcome to call in at any time and ask your opinions. It was a really great. If they're out there and hesitating a little bit about calling in, don't hesitate at all. So, and now I'm going to bring in Doug Simonian, who works with us here at New York Metro Weather. We're going to discuss everything I just spoke about. Doug, are you there? Can you hear me? And are you ready to rock?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I do. I do. I just for everyone listening, I am obviously my audio quality is a little bit reduced today. I was having some microphone problems, so I am using a more basic microphone than typical. So I apologize in advance for that, but hopefully everything comes through fairly smoothly and the show is enjoyable. So let's get right to it. Let's talk a little bit about yesterday, which was a pretty crazy in terms of weather, huh?
Oh yeah, that was a lot of fun. I mean, we had some great shelf clouds during the season, like during the summer, but this might have been the best shelf cloud of the year. So that was pretty fun.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. You know, and not even just the shelf cloud. I mean, it was the entire event. I thought was really cool. And it, from a meteorology standpoint, it featured a lot of great dynamics, and it was a great learning tool also in terms of the fact that you can get severe weather in the Northeast United States even as late as October 30th.
Right. I mean, we had those really nice low-level lapse rates, which helped a lot. And then I think what sometimes I feel like you can get this time of year that you may not get in the summer is actual boundaries nearby. Because, you know, during the summer, the jet stream is a little bit further north, so the actual systems that come in further north. So the triple point, or where the real boundary is between the warm front and the cold front, tends to be further north. But, you know, as we get into fall, these systems come in a little further southward, so the triple point is further south. So a lot of the area was right along the boundary, which helped the storm strengthen. And the storm that gave you that pretty good hail core look to be right along the boundary also. So I think that certainly helped.
Yeah, there was definitely, I actually didn't get a chance to look and see where, a synoptic scale boundary, but something mesoscale was definitely there. And about Union County, New Jersey, parts, that area of Northeast New Jersey, actually got two rounds of storms yesterday. The initial and the second storm, which actually moved from southwest to northeast, which is highly unusual for this time of year. I mean, to see a storm move from southwest to northeast like that. The storm that did moved from southwest to northeast, strengthened very dramatically right near that boundary.
Right. And then also it turned
a better environment.
Like the mean flow with the squall line was northwest to southeast. And that's the line that came through northeast New Jersey, New York City, Long Island, and gave me that, you know, beautiful shelf cloud. But the storm that gave you the hail core came a little bit later as like a discrete cell that instead of southwest to northeast actually was moving So instead of northwest to southeast, it was moving from southwest to northeast, which is left of the mean flow. So I found that interesting. Usually the stronger cells turn right of the mean flow, though generally, you know, the stronger discrete cells do move differently from mean flow. But I was it was just very interesting that it was left of mean flow instead of to the right of mean flow.
Yeah, so that's a good discussion point. For those people listening, one of the things that happened yesterday, as Doug mentioned, was the storms were all moving from northwest to southeast. And then there was one storm, really, that moved from southwest to northeast, going a totally different direction. And what would cause that, really? I mean, what would cause that to happen?
I think, maybe the storm was more organized, or the core of the storm was organized at a different height, or maybe the cloud tops were a little bit higher, so it tapped into more of the upper level, southwesterlies or westerlies than than maybe the low levels. I don't really remember what the low level wind profile was, but a lot of times, you know, when the core of the updraft, let's say, is a little more organized, then the mean wind flow into the storm itself is kind of shifted more towards the mid and upper levels. So maybe that could have been it, though I haven't really taken a great look at the wind profiles we had yesterday. But I do think that was probably part of it. Because actually,
I would agree with that.
Wind profile, the front had already come through at that point, so maybe this isn't the best point of reference, but I feel like maybe the surface winds were a little bit, the low-level winds anyway, were a little bit north of due west. So if the low-level flow is more northwest to southeast, then a less organized storm may move northwest to southeast. But if one discrete cell takes off, then the core of the updraft could have been into those stronger mid-level westerlies and southwesterlies. So, of course, at the sounding I'm looking at was a little bit later. It was like 8 p.m., but so that could have been skewed by the front passing, but maybe that was part of it. Like, the boundary, the mesoscale boundary being nearby or the front being nearby shifted the low-level winds a little bit north of due west. So most storms are going northwest to southeast, but the stronger ones tapped into the stronger westerlies aloft.
Right. Definitely. That would make a lot of sense. And it was, it was really interesting to see that evolution, to see that storm played out. It was really great. I thought it was a really excellent example of how things can change pretty dramatically with a storm moving west, move southwest and northeast. It was a really cool example of meteorology at work.
Right, for sure.
So let's chat a little bit about the pattern here over the next week or two, because things are going to start to change dramatically. At least initially, I think it's going to be live for the system for people, talking about the central United States. But there are a lot of intricacies to the pattern. I mean, what happens first here over the next week or two is a pretty significant warm-up over a large majority of the United States. We talked about the stratospheric vortex splitting, and that did happen. But the cold air from that split, which was working up from the troposphere, actually ended up on the other side of the globe. I mean, it's going to end up in the other side for the purposes. And we did, last week we discussed how that is possible, how the cold can actually end up on the other side of the globe, depending on how the stratospheric vortex split occurs. And that is what is happening currently. But the United States.
Well, I think one of the big reasons why the cold air kind of got transported to the other side of the globe is because the Pacific pattern isn't really ideal for cold weather transport into the U.S. because we still have that vortex kind of near Alaska or in the Bering Strait somewhat, which really prevents the cross-polar flow from taking place. So the cold air really can't press southward into Canada and into the U.S. So then it instead takes the path of least resistance, which is to the other side of the globe. But I don't think we're really going to be getting much in the way of sustained cold until that Pacific pattern reshuffles somewhat. Doesn't mean you can't get a transient trough coming in with a decent cold shot out of Canada. But as far as the true, more Arctic-based cold is concerned, I don't really see us getting any of that until the Pacific reshuffles.
Yeah, that Gulf of Alaska low is really, really going to pump up a ridge across the central United States. I mean, that thing is a behemoth.
Oh yeah, and those things tend to be pretty persistent. They don't move out right away. And I mean, a lot of times these things set up in November and they tend to persist and the models try to move them out of the region, but the models tend to be too quick to transport it out of the way, which I think is
right.
One reason why they tend to rush some pattern changes, and
mm-hmm.
which could be the case with some of the medium range guidance right now anyway.
Yeah. Well, I think another thing that we aren't necessarily talking about is the presence of, you know, one of the big drivers in this pattern. So, you know, this thing over the central United States is a huge, huge ridge. It's in every sense, it's a big deal. And the temperature anomalies are 15, 20 degrees above normal from the Rocky Mountains to the Ohio Valley. And a lot of that has to do with the Pacific Jet. And that's a huge feature
yes,
of this pattern.
Yes. For sure. And I'm actually glad you brought up the Pacific Jet, because something I've been thinking about for a while is the disconnect between the apparent La Nina we have, which, don't get me wrong, there are La Nina conditions in the Pacific, compared with the extremely negative SOI. I know last week we talked briefly about the SOI. Well, the SOI is a Southern Oscillation Index, which compares the sea level pressures between, I think it's with Darwin, is it Darwin, Australia, and Tahiti near South America? I think those are the two regions where their sea level pressures are compared. And the reason why this is important is because these are two regions that are on the extreme western and eastern envelopes of the ENSO region. And of course, one reason why we get a shift into El Niño or La Niña is because of the trade winds in those regions. So if we have, depending on the sea level pressures in Tahiti and Darwin, that can alter the mean wind flow at the surface. And going back to synoptic meteorology from college, there's a persistent feature in weather called the pressure gradient force. Meaning air tends to flow from high, all else being equal, air tends to flow from high pressure to low pressure. So let's say further west towards Australia, the pressures are high. And then further east towards South America, the pressures are low. Then the pressure gradient force says, okay, the air is going to be flowing from Australia towards South America, which is actually a west to east flow. So when you have that west to east flow, that kind of counteracts the increased trade winds and prevents the trade winds from really accelerating from east to west, which would have brought on a stronger La Nina event. And over the past couple of weeks in October, we've had strong negative SOI values, which is more of an indicator of an El Nino type pattern, where the wind flow, as said before, is flowing from west to east across the equatorial Pacific. And I think that's a byproduct of the current Pacific Jet El Nino regime that has been going on right now. So it's kind of interesting how everything is all interconnected, and it's no coincidence that this big El Nino regime with the strong Pacific Jet and the cold air being blocked off from Canada is coinciding with this very strong negative SOI period. The 30-day SOI is getting towards El Nino, which is pretty, I mean, I've never seen something like this before.
I mean, what do you make of that? How do you quantify that when you think about it? You know, you think about the SOI trending away from what we're seeing and what everyone's expecting in terms of a La Nina, and then you get the SOI and the actual pattern in the troposphere right now looking like an El Nino. I mean,
right.
How do you
and
make
like,
a winter forecast and quantify that?
I've been up pretty late the last couple of nights trying to read some things and get a good idea on it. I mean, one theory I have is that, the trade winds that we tend to look at, you know, those zonal wind anomalies, those are 850 millibars, not the surface.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe there could be a disconnect between what's going on at 850 millibars and what's going on at the actual surface, because the SOI is a purely surface-based index. So maybe the surface wind flow, you know, could shift because of the SOI, but the actual the zonal winds above the surface could still be generally east to west. But then again, I do think, you know, the negative SOI that we've seen is one of the reasons why the La Nina hasn't been able to take off. But then what I did was I looked at the OLR plots, you know, outgoing long-wave radiation, which tends to, well, which dictates the amount of convection there is in the Pacific Ocean. During El Nino years, because there's more warm water, more tropical warm water shifted further east across the Pacific, you get more convection there. And if you get more convection, there's less outgoing long-wave radiation into space because those convective cloud tops block it. And then during La Nina years, the warm water is trapped further west towards the western Pacific. And I was expecting, because of this, you know, very negative SOI period, that, you know, the recent OLR would not be La Nina, but the recent OLR is still indicating that the tropical the convection is, you know, further west, which is kind of La Nina-like. Though, of course, it wasn't as impressive as or La Nina-looking as the longer-term plots. So there was a change, but not the change I was expecting. So there's certainly conflicting signals with the atmosphere's response, because, you know, I would think, whoa, look at this gigantic El Nino response we have in the Northern Pacific and the SOI. I would have thought that would have done a lot to the 7-day OLR, and it really hasn't. It's done a little bit, but it hasn't done a lot. So it's the fact that, you know, it's still hard to really say what kind of ENSO state we're in heading into November for a winter forecast. I mean, while it certainly makes meteorology very interesting, this is one of the great things about the science, it's also, I mean, kind of frustrating sometimes too when you're trying to make a winter forecast.
Yeah, I think that's when you look at it from a seasonal standpoint, is when it gets the most frustrating, because it's not just a short term thing. I mean, this has been since the middle of October now that this value has been, and it does jump around. The daily value jumps.
Yeah.
I mean, the daily value can jump, you know, there was, I better look at the data, but it was in a 2-day span, it would jump from negative 12 to positive 12.
Right.
So,
yeah,
I mean,
that's
what the 30-day averages are for. And see, this is a La Nina expectation here, and we're looking at an El Nino pattern for all intents and purposes.
Yeah. I mean, right, the 30-day and 90-day are supposed to weed out the daily fluctuations to get a better idea of the long-term picture. And, yeah, the 30-day is negative 5.1. And generally speaking, anything negative 7 or below is an indicator of El Nino, and anything positive 7 or above is an indicator of La Nina. Now, to be fair, the 90-day SOI, which is, of course, a much longer time period, and I think probably a better representation over what's truly going on, it's still positive, but it's only positive 4.5, which is well below positive 7. Well, of course, a couple of weeks ago, the 90-day was in the sevens and even in the eights, but it's not like it ever really got to an impressively high value to begin with. And, you know, with a 30-day SOR tanking, the daily's still pretty low. You know, it really clouds the seasonal picture.
Yeah, no doubt. And I think, you know, that's something that is going to have to come under continued observation here. That's the best way to put it, over the next couple of days and weeks as we go through November to see how it behaves. Because as you start getting towards the end of November without any support for a La Nina type of pattern, you know, you can say what you want about the numbers. You can say that the SOI and the Eurasian snow cover is, you know, just kind of fallacy or overblown, whatever the case might be. But the proof is in the pudding when it comes to the pattern. And if you still have an El Nino pattern with a raging Pacific...
Yes.
We're going to have to really start to monitor the changes here because we're starting the first half of November out with a very warm pattern. And if the Pacific jet doesn't want to calm down, any type of pattern change is going to have some problems, you know, setting its foot down.
Right. And then it affects the analogs too. I mean, a lot of, you know, weak La Nina December analogs generally have a pretty cold entire northern tier of the U.S. But, you know, as we talked about before, these El Nino-induced strong Pacific jet periods tend to last longer than modeled. So if this lasts through a good chunk of November, then it's hard to really use weak La Nina analogs with confidence in going into December, despite the fact that, yeah, the OLR anomalies are still in the La Nina picture. The fact is the troposphere and the SOI are saying otherwise, and we're getting closer and closer to crunch time.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that is the last line there, getting closer and closer to crunch time is the key. Because you're getting to the point now where if you have a big time negative pattern in terms of getting colder snow across a lot of the country, and you're looking at a pattern that is not supportive at all for cold air or snow, which is kind of what we're involved in right now, regardless of the season, the pattern that we're looking at right now is just not good. So
right.
if you know you have that in place, you know, it gets to the point where you have to start to look at changes and, you know, what's going to happen. Now, we can assume, based on what we know about teleconnections and what we see with the atmospheric evolution, that there will be a change at the end of November. But exactly how that shakes down is, I think, you know, looking at how the pattern evolves is going to be key, because knowing the base state that we have, which is with this humongously aggressive Pacific jet and a trough in the Gulf of Alaska, it's not going to be easy to flip the pattern to something that really gets cold air into the central and eastern United States by December 1st.
Right. Though on the bright side, I mean, the optimistic side way you can look at it for snow lovers is that a lot of the models were showing the change occurring really early. Last week's models are showing a rapid flip by mid-November, which is really, I mean, you know, it's hard to get sustained cold and snow into the Northeast in mid-November. So you might be better, well, the snow lovers anyway, might be better off in the long run with things taking a little bit longer to progress, with the Pacific jet maybe hanging on a little bit longer and then eventually retrograding a bit. So while November itself wouldn't be as cold in that scenario, you're doing a more gradual step down into a more favorable Pacific towards the, you know, the third week in November, and then maybe in late November, assuming that progression were to actually occur, then maybe you can get into a better pattern by December, even with still some Pacific influence, but you know, assuming there is going to be a change, I'd prefer it, you know, to for Snow Lovers to wait a little bit than to have had it just kind of rush in and usher in right away.
That I agree with. I mean, I think it's one of those things. This let's talk a little bit too about what exactly is going to happen here over the next couple of days, next couple of weeks, because the pattern is forecast by many models to change pretty dramatically. If you were to take a look at the pattern where it is this week, the middle of this week, and then look at what the guidance is pointing us to towards the middle and end of November, it's very different. And what about
right.
What to you is the most dramatic change?
Well, the most dramatic change that has been consistent in the models, although perhaps maybe delayed somewhat compared to guidance of last week, is the higher heights into the EPO region and into Alaska, and that vortex that's kind of sitting in the Bering Strait or north of the Aleutians, kind of moving out and kind of drifting southwest. It's an El Nino retrogression pattern, which is really kind of strange to see, considering the ENSO base state. But that is the feature. At least I'm actually scrolling through the GFS ensembles right now, but that is the feature that does seem to be most consistent in occurring by maybe, let's see, like even into November 9th, November 10th, you are getting a little bit of a weaker Pacific jet. Like the Pacific jet kind of pulls back a bit. It doesn't necessarily weaken, but it pulls back a bit. So then you get what we call a jet extension, because it's hard to keep a Pacific jet in a straight west to east line so strong for the entire Pacific. So if the Pacific jet moves back a bit, then usually at some point what happens is the jet eventually weakens if it weakens, it tends to meander a bit. So you get that Pacific jet pulling back a bit, just which forces the jet itself to weaken south of Alaska. And then you get higher heights out in front of it into Alaska and into the Pacific Northwest and Western Canada. So you get like a kind of like a positive PNA, sort of negative EPO combination as we head into maybe the second week or into the middle of November. That is the change I've been seeing the most, though it's going to take some time for the cold air to actually bottle itself up into Canada again, because you're still going to need more of a true entire retrogression of the Pacific to reload the cold in Canada, but it's a start.
Yeah, I think so too. To be honest with you, that's one of the key points that you just brought up, was the Pacific changes. One of the big things that you keep to create a pattern that supports ridging over the central United States. And that in turn really makes it difficult to get cold air across a lot of the United States. When you have trough near the Aleutian Islands, you get a ridge on the west coast of the United States, and that trough near the Aleutian Islands allows the airflow to come into the poles and almost develop a cross-polar flow, dropping cold air into the United States.
Right.
Huge deal. But if you have a pattern where the big thing is, even if you bring the trough back to a position south of the Aleutian Islands, if you have ridging that develops all the way through Canada, you're still cutting off the cross-polar flow. So you can have a trough in the Aleutian Islands, so you retrograde the pattern, but you still don't have any cold air in Canada. And if you still have the Pacific jet dominating the pattern like that, that's not going to be good enough to really change the pattern across the United States.
Right, because you can retrograde the Pacific jet enough so that you get the weakened jet extension that promotes ridging, which is obviously a good start for getting, a cooler pattern in the East, but that's not necessarily enough to really entirely flip everything to the point where you're going to constantly get cold into Canada or the colder source regions in Canada to actually develop and then send themselves southeastward. But what you can get is some, transient shots of average to maybe a few degrees below average at times with that, and then once that trough moves out, you get a little bit more modification. But then the key is, of course, is for that, hopefully, that the Pacific jet and the low south of the Aleutians will either retrograde enough, or the low south of the Aleutians will move southward enough to amplify the flow enough in the EPO region or in Alaska to actually allow that cold source region to develop. And the GFS ensembles do that pretty nicely, but sometimes the GFS ensembles rush pattern changes.
Oh yeah. That's another thing. I mean, we can look at the pattern and say that the pattern, like we said earlier, it's really a step down process. In getting the cold air into Canada first, you have to get cold air established there first. The key.
Right, especially this time of year when.
So.
Well. Yeah, not this time of year, but even like into later November, early December, when seasonal averages are still pretty warm. So you need that. You generally need that cold source region.
The Pacific jet and the way that it's modeled to be, it kind of gives you an uneasy feeling as to how and when that pattern change is going to happen.
Yeah, I'm a little uneasy about it myself, but I was also uneasy about the model showing it happening so quickly, because I hate cliche phrases, but I don't really like just having a really rapid flip into a cold snow pattern throughout November. I just, that's too early. But then again, it's also uneasy seeing those first signs of things that we see all the time with the, the Pacific jet lingering longer than expected. And then sometimes I think what happens is the weekly guidance, so the European weekly guidance in the longer term, may not really have a great grasp on the Pacific jet, and they look at other factors like, not that these factors are wrong, but other factors like sea surface temperature anomalies and other forcing mechanisms to determine their forecasts rather than, strongly influencing the current Pacific jet regime into it.
Yeah, yeah. And, I think there's a little bit more to this, too, because going to flip in November, it'll be delayed. What's going to happen with the Pacific jet? I don't think that it's necessarily required that the pattern flip.
Right.
You don't want things to a specific pattern. This is, there's no behind this. There is some sort of propensity for things to stick, especially I feel in winter when the wavelengths change. More often than not, when you see a pattern settle in to start, it's very difficult to change it the longer the winter goes on. So what you don't want to see, if you're hoping for, that would be a very bad sign.
Yeah, it's always annoying. I mean, not to make any direct comparisons, because this year is very different from that year, but that kind of thing happened in 2011, 2012, where that big vortex in the Bering Strait just never really moved out, and that pattern kind of established itself throughout the winter. But, of course, sometimes you can get shifts in tropical forcing and such that can help, move the pattern in your favor later in the winter. So while, I do agree that you don't like seeing some things, establish themselves, well, such as a really strong Pacific jet, you don't like seeing things like that establish themselves early in the winter. I do feel like climatology does generally say that if there's going to be a very strong Pacific jet feature in the winter, it tends to occur more so in December than in the other months. But you know, that then again, you know, it's still considering the muddled, conflicting information with the negative SOI, the La Nina-like OLR anomalies, which usually would indicate a weaker Pacific jet. You know, La Nina forcing tends to promote high pressure in the Aleutians, which is obviously very different from what we are seeing in the model guidance. So maybe in the longer term, the La Nina tropical forcing could actually, change things around a bit.
Yeah, and I would think with too about the MJ, actually, I would think maybe you'd be good at breaking this down in a simplistic way, but how do you really simplistic? We'll talk a little bit about the upcoming MJO pulse, but I mean, when someone asks you about the MJO, I mean, how do you describe it?
Okay, it's a good question. Because there are the MJO is a byproduct of tropical convection. Well, there are a lot of different ways to measure tropical convection and the way and its ripple effects downstream based on where the tropical convection is located. There's the general El Nino or La Nina base state of tropical forcing and convection that occurs over longer time scales. But then there's the MJO or Kelvin waves that model the tropical forcing and convection and pulses over shorter time scales embedded within those longer time scales. So the thing is, usually anyway, when the ENSO signal is weaker, that background seasonal state tropical convection is not as strong, which allows the MJO's bi-weekly tropical convection and forcing to stand out a little bit more. And of course, right now, we are in a pretty weak ENSO base state where that seasonal tropical forcing over that long time scale is not as relevant, which could make the MJO pulses a better indicator as to what's going on in the tropics and thus more coherent singular signals from it. And I'm glad you brought up the MJO, because the MJO pulse could be one thing that will greatly help the pattern shift in mid-late November into one more favorable, because in the European Ensemble MJO guidance showed a pretty strong pulse, MJO pulse, initially moving through phase 8 in the second week of November, and then entering the third week of November, looked like it was ready to go into phase 1, which generally paints
right.
Tropical forcing in a better spot for more North Pacific ridging and a weaker Pacific jet and more downstream colds for the United States.
Gee. When the hemisphere, when that's one of those things where how it really truly affects the weather, the analogs are pretty sturdy. I mean, for the most part, when you get an MJ certitude, the weather are pretty straightforward, and I think there's been great research and great studies about the MJO, and it's given race to understand exactly how it behaves and where things are going. That being said, quiet, and there's a lot of about the hemisphere can kind of look, there's control it. So when you look at everything we talk about, you look at the SOI, you can talk about other things throughout the tropical Pacific, things like that. pulse, I think that really takes control. And so when you look at the MJO really getting more amplified, phase 8, phase 1, argument that the pattern. Reality a little bit. Did I lose you?
Oh, sorry. No, your audio cut off just for a brief bit. You were mentioning something about the MJO going in from phase 8 to phase 1.
Yeah. The main point really was that the MJO, whenever it gains amplitude, it tends, when the MJO does not have a ton of amplitude, the pattern tends to look for other, it seems it looks for other drivers that control it.
Right.
So when the MJO gains amplitude and goes through certain stages, it seems like the pattern snaps back a little bit to reality. So let's see something similar here as the MJO gains amplitude and heads through phases 8 and 1. The pattern that has been behaving a little bit differently than one would expect, given where the tropical Pacific is, we could see it snap back to reality now as the MJO goes through this transition.
Yeah, that's a good point because, with weaker ENSOs, you tend to get more well-defined MJO pulses, which, as you said, could snap things back to reality because part of reality with weaker ENSOs is the stronger MJO. So things could return, more so to what is typical, but a lot of times you look at these MJO composites from based on ENSO state, the month, and the MJO phase, and they paint a certain picture, but you can't take those pictures literally because there still are even if the MJO is pretty strong, there are still going to be other background drivers that may shift the anomalies that you see in the composites in different directions somewhat. So it's certainly, it's certainly a useful tool, but, of course, not every MJO pulse is equal.
Yeah, that's the thing, too. I mean, every pulse is different, and this one will have its own behavior. The analogs, I think the analogs for November, phase 8 and phase 1, you mentioned they have, phase 8 is more ridging over.
But yeah, phase 8 is more ridging in the east, and then phase 1 is more troughing in the east.
Also, I mean, if I recall, it also, the phase 1 also has the ones as well. Which, is it part of the pattern change? Pretty big part of the pattern change as we move forward. Look, if I could, straightforward, how do you think the pattern evolves here over the next couple of weeks? How do you think things go through November 1st, but from November 1st onward, what do you think happens across the United States?
Well, I mean, the first week of November for most of the U.S. looks pretty porchy, pretty warm, particularly in the central part of the U.S. where records could be broken because, we still have that pretty strong Pacific jet plowing warm air into Canada, and then you have a pretty strong ridge building into that Pacific jet, into the plains. So there could be record-breaking warmth there, but in the east, it's the first week will be above average, but maybe a little bit closer to average than most of the rest of the country because, downstream of that ridge will be a trough moving into the east with that cold front on Thursday afternoon, Thursday evening. And it looks like some of that trough, some of that cold air will be kind of breaking off of the tropospheric polar vortex. So you could get another one of those transient but not unmodified Canadian air masses into the weekend. But of course, that depends on how amplitude this trough gets and if the ridging will have a tendency to take over. even spreading further east. So we're going to, the east is still going to be above average in the first week of November, but it's going to be in more of a battleground between that huge record-breaking ridge in the plains and that little shortwave trough, well, kind of a long-wave trough, really, actually, moving into southeast Canada and into the northeast. So we'll have, in the northeast, we'll have more warm days than cold days, but there will still be some transient shot of chilly air. And then what happens...
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I think... Go ahead, continue. I'm sorry.
Well, no, I mean, and then what happens after that is once that... Well, the GFS has the trough kind of lingering a little bit longer, like giving like a pretty chilly below average weekend, nothing record-breaking or anything, but chilly weekend, and the European moves it out a little quicker. But either way, once that trough moves out, then while the ridge itself looks to weaken in the plains, there's still going to be a whole large area of Pacific influence throughout the entire U.S. in the beginning of the second week of November. And then, you know, hopefully, you know, for snow lovers at that point, you know, the Pacific reshuffles. And then you might get a brief, you know, PNA spike in the west. So there could be really, you know, very warm anomalies second week of November in the west. And then with the trough downstream of that in the east, you might get at times bouts of normal to below average temperatures embedded in the overall warm Pacific regime. So I lean slightly above average in the east second week of November and well above average further west. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the general retrograde idea of the pattern lends that to, you know, the bigger warm anomalies during the middle of the country and even part of the eastern part of the country during the first week. Although the trough this weekend coming into the northeast could erase some of those big positive anomalies. But all that aside, the bigger warmth, I think, retrogrades further west gradually. So I'm not going to go as far as saying big negative anomalies by week three, but the pattern should relax enough to support temperatures closer to normal by the end of week two and week three, with that positive anomalies probably near the west coast. I would think the warmer temperatures will remain near the west coast, maybe to the Rockies. But I think the big deal is going to be, you know, how amplified is the trough and how good is the cold air source?
Yes, for sure.
But the overall idea is that you'll have more troughing from the international border in Montana and North Dakota extending to the south and east towards the Great Lakes. But, as we've said, the questions that are yet to be answered are, you know, what is it cold over Canada? Because you can get a trough that digs all the way down to the east coast, but if there's no cold air source, it doesn't matter in terms of getting cold. So you can get a big trough, and they'll have big negative anomalies in the mid levels of the atmosphere, and all the maps that everyone posts will look blue and purple. But guess what? It'll be 45 degrees because there's no cold air, and that could be a big problem.
Yeah, I definitely agree that into week three, there's still going to be, even with the trough in the east, because of, you know, the Pacific retrogression and the ridge out west, there's still going to be some Pacific influence on the pattern, which would tend to modify the cold air somewhat. So yeah, I definitely agree with you there. Maybe by week four is when, you know, the negative anomaly south of the becomes more pronounced south of the Aleutians, and then you actually get a true negative EPO ridge going more poleward into Alaska, and then you get the cross polar flow kind of sliding down. So the trough has a good source region by then. But week three, I definitely still think there will be some Pacific influence, so that the trough that we do get may just cool us off to average, to slightly below average. And then when a trough, you know, temporarily moves out, then above average again. So maybe like seasonal to slightly below average week three. And then maybe week four is when you could get a little chillier. But then again, as we talked about before, the Pacific influence it doesn't just go away, even with retrogression, even with the weaker jet, it's still seems to have a presence that may prevent a true cold flip. but it is a step down process in the right direction towards colder temperatures and maybe a snow threat later in the month into early December.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's the key moving forward is it's a step down process, and it's going to be gradual. The third week of November, towards the end of the month, and then we start to look forward to December and see where we are from there, which, you know, you tend to favor with that idea that December will be normal, maybe possibly slightly below normal, with the potential for lots of activity in terms of frozen precipitation as well. So that's the general idea moving forward, and I think that pretty much covers it. I mean, anything else you wanted to touch on?
Just kind of reiterate another point, you know, it's that, of course, you know, a lot of the weak Nina December analogs, you know, point to high confidence of cold temperatures in the, upper Midwest and through the Great Lakes. And then that could mean that we could be on the battleground between, those cold air masses and maybe some residual ridging in the southern states that you tend to get in, La Nina analogs, which could mean increased precipitation and storm threats in the east in the beginning of December. And I think that might have been a signal on some of the European weekly guidance. And that precept could especially be the case if maybe there is still some, El Nino lag from, that negative SOI period that we've been having, or, the previous strong El Nino we had last winter, adding all that heat into the atmosphere. So when you combine the potential temperature gradient that could ensue between the big trough potential, the upper Midwest and Great Lakes, with maybe some, more warmth in the south. So we're in the battleground, combined with maybe some, leftover residual El Nino influence, you could get low average precipitation maybe in early December as well.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I think that's the thing to watch is the transition. You have an active pattern possibly, as well as a pattern that's trending more cold, and that the combination of all of that could lead to a lot of activity as you head towards December, in which point you start looking more significantly at the potential for winter weather.
Right, especially in the interior.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've already seen it. We've already seen one event in the interior.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
I think we continue to look for that moving forward, and that's the idea. But it's been fun over the last couple of weeks. I feel like every time we have this show, we get a little closer to winter, and our thoughts get a little more refined. So it's been really cool to kind of go through that whole process and see that kind of unfold. So next week, hopefully we will chat again and we'll have some more thoughts and talk a little further about it and be a little bit further along in the ideas. We will have released our winter forecast to the premium members by the time we talk next week. So that's exciting, obviously. We will be talking to you guys next week about the winter forecast. And we're hoping to bring on a couple guests. I'm not going to ruin the surprise just yet. But it's going to be fun episode next week as well. So, Doug, it's been a pleasure once again chatting with you about all things weather here. We are going to wrap the show up just a minute or two early tonight, so everyone can go ahead and eat your candy and go watch Monday Night Football, I guess.
Yep, sounds good. And also, if you missed a good chunk of the show, all of our episodes, including this one, will be archived on, I think the link is nymetroweather.com/weatherize, right? Is that where they're archived?
Yep.
So if you missed a good chunk of the show or you want to, or you just like us so much that you want to listen to us again, then all of our podcasts will be archived at nymetroweather.com/weathereyes. So feel free to check out that link and to listen to this episode again and all the other previous episodes.
Absolutely. And it'll be cool when we get to the point where the winter forecast comes out and we can kind of go back and listen to how our thoughts evolved over the time period. So thank you guys again for joining us. If you are interested in getting our winter forecast next week, we do send it out to our premium clients. Head on over to the page and get signed up, and we will be able to give it to you on November 7th. It's coming out around 12 o'clock p.m. on November 7th. We'll have all the details. If you don't feel like signing up for premium membership, you should at least give it a shot. And if not, we release the winter forecast to the public on November 14th, so you could just hang tight for another week. But next week we will be chatting about it here, so you'll at least be able to get an idea as to what we're talking about for the winter ahead. Thanks again for joining us, Doug. Thanks again for all your thoughts, and to all our listeners that have joined us again for another week. We're really excited about where the show is going. And again, join us next week. We'll have a couple more guests. It's going to be exciting. Stay tuned during this week for the news on who it's going to be. And we'll talk a little further about it during the week, and we'll see you guys next week. Again, for Doug Simonian, I am John Hominuk, and this has been episode 5 of Weather Eyes. Thanks, guys. Have a good night.